Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
In the past few years, a paperback by a Swiss ex-convict, Eric von Däniken, has made a considerable splash in Europe and in this country, Chariots of the Gods. This particular book has had a very wide circulation, has resulted in a feature-length motion picture film, which has made the rounds of most of the first-run theaters and must be pretty far down the line by now. Recall it went through Ithaca last year. Has been the subject of at least two hour-long TV specials, In Search of Ancient Astronauts and In Search of Ancient Mysteries, and therefore has stirred up a great deal of interest. Basically, Eric von Däniken claims that if one accepts the view that life will naturally result whenever the universe runs for a long enough time under proper conditions, and if one understands then that our own sun, being only about 5 billion years old, is only about a third as old as some of the older stars in our galaxy, then it would follow that we would expect that there might be intelligent life many other locations in our own galaxy and in other galaxies. And if our star is indeed a third-generation star, and if at least second-generation stars or so have got all of the mix of elements that could produce life, then it would appear that we should expect that there should be some civilizations far advanced beyond our own. Now, we've been in space age 10 years, say, 15 years, more accurate, if you count Sputnik. So we're just barely getting started in this space age. But a civilization 5 billion years older than ours, if it still exists, might be 5 billion years into the space age. As we are being hopeful now of getting to other planets within the next generation, it might be indeed that they would be able to have solved the problem of getting out of their own stellar system and going to another stellar system to visit, or traveling perhaps even a substantial distance across a galaxy to visit around. In von Däniken's view then, with all of those stars out there, with perhaps 100 billion stars in their own galaxy, and perhaps 100 billion galaxies within the range of our best telescopes, we should expect to find some very advanced civilizations, and we should expect that they would have found us now and then. So von Däniken feels that these men would have entered the space age, some of these men, men is used very broadly here, and have traveled through space. I'm here using, of course, very antique-type slides from our first 10 years of the space age, traveled perhaps by unidentified flying objects across our galaxy, or perhaps even from another galaxy, and began to look around the area, and finally lit upon this third planet around this rather average sort of star, which we call our sun. Here we find a planet with oxygen atmosphere, large amount of water, and at least for the kind of life we know about, this is a rather nice environment. So we would not be surprised that if there are millions of such civilizations far advanced beyond ours out there, some of them would have found us, would have orbited around the Earth, looked the place over, and finally come down and landed and looked around. Now, according to von Däniken, if this happened some millions or thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago, man on this planet would have been in a very primitive condition, living in rather primitive type of caves, having a very primitive diet, and things of this sort. And so man, in a very primitive state here, would have been amazed when he saw these people coming from outer space, these beings coming from outer space, coming down in rocket ships and landing. And naturally, man being amazed by them would have been inclined to worship them, would have been inclined to look on them as gods, and would perhaps have attempted to draw pictures of them and worship them. And so von Däniken points to such things as this cliff drawing from the Sahara Desert and says, this is obviously a spaceman. Whoever saw a person that looked like that? Well, yeah. And this fellow here, obviously a spaceman. Notice his antenna. there on his head. Von Däniken does not explain what these four hot dogs sticking out of his arms and legs are, but the view is that these strange pictures, which we do see strange pictures done by primitives, we see some strange pictures done by moderns, for that matter, that these strange pictures are evidence that man was visited by beings from outer space of a very advanced technology. Not only so, but von Däniken believes that these very advanced races which came to this planet themselves built structures on our planet. And he would point to such things as Stonehenge, where according to Gerald Hawkins, we have a device which will allow you to calculate eclipses. We'll give you the rising at the solstices and equinoxes, etc., of the sun, things of this variety. And so he would say, von Däniken would say, men didn't know how to do this in antiquity. This requires special technology, at least as regards knowledge here. And besides, look at the size of those stones. Ancient men did not have cranes. How are you going to explain these stones? His suggestion, these were placed by men with a great technology who had rocket ships to lift these stones and set them in the holes, things of that variety, and who had the scientific knowledge necessary to set up a machine that would predict eclipses. He'd point also to things like the Great Pyramid. This is the second pyramid here, actually. Easier to get a good shot of it when I was down that way. Looking at the huge size of the Great Pyramid and the Second Pyramid and the other pyramids at that location, the Great Pyramid running over 2 million stones, averaging a couple tons apiece. Looking at the primitiveness of man, ancient man, he would say, how could men have done this? Looking at the very fine jointing between the cap, between the surface stones, which still remain here in the Second Pyramid up near the top, he would say, that's too fine a work for primitives. This must be the work of someone with a laser who could cut very straight cuts on stone and fit them together so that you couldn't put a knife blade between them. He would look perhaps also at things which no longer remain, but which we have information from in antiquity, such as the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, a very large, essentially irrigated garden, except set up on terraces, and with apparently, according to ancient sources, elevator of some sort inside to lift the water up to the top. So he'd point to things like this and say, here too, we have an evidence of things that seem to go beyond what ancient man was capable of. Therefore, he says, a race with super technology, or many races with super technology, must have visited this planet in the past. Besides, according to von Däniken, this would allow us to explain all of the miracle accounts in antiquity, those in the Bible, such as the crossing of the Red Sea, and also those in various classical literature, such as the supernatural aid given to both sides at the battle before Troy in the Iliad. So this sort of claim would be made by von Däniken. The stories of miracles that we have in antiquity are not invented stories. They are misunderstood events in which super technology, not miraculous power, is used. So basically there, we have outlined von Däniken's thesis, von Däniken's position. What kind of reaction has von Däniken's position produced? Well, he sold a lot of books. So he came out with a sequel, God from Outer Space, over here on the right. That sold a lot of books too. Came out with a second sequel, Gold of the Gods. Meanwhile, other people jumped on the bandwagon, R.L. Dionne, God Drives a Flying Saucer. Joseph Blumrick, The Spaceships of Ezekiel. You go to a moderately well-stocked paperback bookstore, you'll find on the astrology, all sorts of things of this sort. The Coming of the Gods, Gods and Devils from Outer Space, Limbo and the Lost from Outer Space, The Truth About Flying Saucers, Legacy of the Gods, Supernature, We Are Not the First, Gods and Spacemen from the Ancient East, etc. The Gods Unknown, Strange World. So most of these are the same thesis presented by other people. They wouldn't be publishing them if they weren't selling. So somebody, I think, is getting excited about these things. Well, evangelical Christians, I think, are concerned about this matter also, because it does undercut, if it's correct, a very basic feature of Christianity, and that is that there's a God who created the universe, who interacts in history, and who has done certain things. That the material given to Moses at Sinai, a complete legal system, detailed statements of the nature of God and of how men should conduct themselves, these sorts of things felt to be under attack, as well as a number of other things of that sort in Scripture. So this is an attempt to replace a view that there's a God by a view that there is only advanced beings with a super technology. So the major work that has been done from evangelical Christian point of view is Crash Go the Chariots by Clifford Wilson, a former director of the Australian Institute of Archaeology. A brief article has been done in Eternity magazine by Edwin Yamauchi, professor of history at Miami University, Oxford, Ohio. These are two from the evangelical position that I've seen. Christian Century, a liberal theological magazine, had an article on von Däniken. The remarks of Christian Century were rather interesting. They said, von Däniken has the same outlook on the world that we do, but we don't like his archaeology. So the liberal theologians have had another way to try and do this for about a century, but many people are not satisfied with it. It's a very complicated method of trying to remove this sudden appearance of laws at the time of Moses and scatter them for about 1,000 years later, which has proved problematical for a number of reasons, not only the subject of this lecture. So we have had these responses. What we'd like to do this evening is look at archaeology. It's not one area. And examine von Däniken's thesis in the light of archaeology. Very difficult to examine his thesis in the light of science. We can point out that we know of no way to travel distances to other galaxies, nor any way to travel substantial distances in our own galaxy in reasonable times and with reasonable amounts of energy. But he can always say, aha, some way will show up. He suggests two or three ways, which are absurd, but he could still be right that some way might show up. We can't know, and no way to answer that. But we can, I think, examine the matter of archaeology and see whether he is handling the archaeological evidence with integrity, and to see whether his thesis that, getting some advice on how to use the mic, which doubtless is helpful, to see whether we want to examine then von Däniken's thesis in the light of archaeology, because here's a place where we will be able, I think, to see whether he is correct in his claim that there is no other explanation for these things he brings up than super technology or the supernatural. And he does not want the supernatural, so this thing we want to examine. So let's look first of all at archaeology and ask ourselves, what sort of information do we get from archaeology? What sort of things can we learn from archaeology? Perhaps the best known sorts of things which archaeological diggings uncover are cities. This is the ancient city of Corinth, major seaport just north of Peloponnesus in Greece during the first 2-3 centuries AD. This city has been long covered by eroded materials coming down from the hills. And if you look carefully here, you'll see modern houses back on the towards the skyline. And you'll see that there's about 15 feet of dirt that has been removed to get down to this level. They've actually, over many acres, removed very large amounts of debris in order to get down to the surface of this first century city. We have a tendency to imagine that since we perhaps have an ancestor back 2 or 3 generations who could not read or write, many of us do, that if that's so, then you extrapolate back why by the time you get back 500 years, they must hardly have known your name. And by the by the time you get back 1,000 years, they didn't have sense enough to come in out of the rain. And by the time you get back 2,000 years, how could they have done anything? Well, if that were true, how could they draw the pictures of these spacemen? We really need to realize that civilization, as far as we can examine it, is not a matter of gradually getting great improvements which have gradually built up, but that we've had great sudden build-ups of a high civilized level, a very considerable development into some area, such as philosophy or law or government, something of that sort, over perhaps a very short period of time, and then for some reason the whole thing caves in after a few centuries. So a very promising start made in philosophy by the early Greeks, around 500, 400 BC, Ionians and their successors, some rather spectacular things done by the Romans in law and in governmental operations, and yet we often see these things cave in. Perhaps the of the 8 or 10 finest playwrights in the English language, nearly half of them lived within a generation of each other at the Elizabethan period. Why is that? Why such a sudden spurt of human ability, and then perhaps followed by a decline? Well, von Däniken's model doesn't have room for that sort of thing, unless he would say, we've got somebody coming in from outer space to give the information. So one thing in archaeology we have is an opportunity to examine the cities and to see what's actually there. What was done in antiquity? Another city, which we'll have a little look at also, ancient Jerusalem. Just begun to be able to do some excavations in Jerusalem since the 1967 war. These excavations that we see right here in the foreground being done just south of the mount on which the temple once stood. More valuable in some ways than the cities themselves are inscriptions when we can find them. This is an inscription at Corinth, the lintel of a door, and a Latin inscription. The top line of the inscription says, Imp Kaiser, Divi, Antonin, P.E. To the divine Caesar, Emperor, Antoninus Pius. We know that this particular inscription carved to him, presumably in connection with his reign. So inscriptions, when they're available in a city, give us some information about when things were built, and that's often very valuable. Another rather valuable feature of archaeology are coins. It's a strange thing to imagine that coins are worth much, but sorry about that. But coins tell us something about order of kings in a given country, whether or not given cities had the right to mint coinage, something about religious ideas or political ideas at the time, depending on what's said, and interestingly enough, something about the economic situation. If we find a coin is half gold and half silver, say, at one point in a fellow's reign, and 5 years later in his reign, it's three-quarter silver, you get the idea that inflation is going on, or that the fellow has found a clever way to tax. So we can learn some rather interesting things just from coinage. The most important of all, however, of ancient archaeological materials that we can get would be extensive written materials. Extensive written materials. This is just a facsimile of one of the Dead Sea Scrolls with the text as it would stand in modern Hebrew printed out on the left-hand side there. We have found in the last century very extensive collections of cuneiform inscriptions on clay tablets in several locations in the Middle East, which give us detailed information about the economy, about the political situation, about history even, in a number of different areas. The Assyrian Empire, the city of Ugarit in northern Syria, things of this sort. We've also found the Dead Sea Scrolls in Palestine near the Dead Sea, which give us information about a particular religious group at that time. We found a very large, relatively very large, about 12 volume, a collection of books from an early Gnostic heresy in Egypt in early centuries Christian period. So we occasionally find very spectacular written finds that give us a lot of detailed information about some little particular thing. And this sort of information is a thing from which we build up our archaeological views. Now what we'd like to do this evening then is to, using this sort of material, making reference occasionally to Wilson's remarks in Crash for the Chariots, and making reference to a work by Sprague de Camp, The Ancient Engineers, which discusses the technology that we know something about in antiquity, to deal with a number of von Däniken's points. Now, we'd like to deal with them in a somewhat roundabout way, however, and that is by visiting several archaeological sites, some of which he will mention and some of which he will not, and try and see what they tell us about ancient technology, about ancient building practices and things of that variety. The first site we'd like to visit, then, is in central Lebanon, the name of the town, Baalbek. Baalbek, named for one of the ancient Canaanite gods, Baal. You may be familiar with in the Old Testament. This particular Baal, Baal of the Valley, Baal Becca. This god was worshipped by the Canaanites probably from 1500 BC or earlier. But as you come down towards the classical period, the Greeks came into this area with Alexander the Great, and they identified Baal with Zeus. And then later, the Romans came into this area, and they identified Baal with Jupiter, since they had already identified Zeus with Jupiter. At Baalbek, we have a rather impressive set of ruins, of which this is a reconstruction. You see a large temple in the background sitting on a platform. This is the temple to Jupiter Heliopolis. We have an older temple standing in the forecourt in front of it, which is a Canaanite temple. And then we have several courts here, a rectangular court, and then a hexagonal court, and then a front entrance here at Baalbek, as well as a couple of other temples which do not show up on this diagram. Now, if we look at von Däniken, he has this to say about Baalbek. North of Damascus lies the terrace of Baalbek, a platform built of stone blocks, some of which have sides more than 65 feet long and weigh nearly 2,000 tons. Until now, archaeologists have not been able to give a convincing explanation why, how, and by whom the terrace of Baalbek was built. However, Russian professor Agrest considers it possible that the terrace is the remains of a gigantic airfield. That's von Däniken on Baalbek. If I can get this thing to reverse here. The platform, the terrace, which von Däniken mentions, which is said to be the remains of a gigantic airfield, is the terrace on which the temple of Jupiter Heliopolis stands. You can see the stairway in front of it there. It goes around. It's a good-sized terrace, probably 200 by 300 feet. Not exactly a gigantic airfield, however. And if the whole thing was built of these big stones, it'd be rather hard to run off with all the stones to get down from a gigantic airfield to this rather fiddling thing, which you could launch a rocket off of rather nicely, but not a gigantic airfield. Von Däniken also says, built of stone blocks, some of which have sized more than 65 feet long and weigh nearly 2,000 tons. There is one such block, still in the quarry at Baalbek. The blocks which are in the terrace, there are three big ones. There are a number of big blocks, but three largest ones in the terrace itself are about 55 feet long and weigh about 900 tons. That's still a lot of weight, no question about that. And I think he raises a problem here which we'll want to investigate more thoroughly, but do need to point out that he has faked it a bit there. Here's the rectangular court in Baalbek, and you can see about what shape the ruins are in at the present time. Some of the upper structures were put in by the Muslims to fortify the place after Roman times. This is all that remains of the gigantic temple of Jupiter Heliopolis, which stood on the platform. Six pillars. Those pillars are really quite substantial, although it's not terribly obvious from this picture. You don't have anybody standing there to give a comparison. These pillars are 65 feet long themselves, but do not weigh anything like 2,000 tons. They're one piece. Each pillar is a single piece. Unlike the Roman method of making pillars in blocks, that is, they would make short sections and set them on top of one another, the Romans liked one-piece pillars. And so these six pillars about 65 feet long, all standing, still standing after several thousand years. Here is a couple of the bases of these pillars, where the pillars have been knocked off. The diameter of these pillar bases is 7.5 feet. So you have a pillar 7.5 feet across, made of granite, 65 feet long. Now, here's your 2,000 ton stone. 65 feet long, about 14 feet high, about 12 feet wide, around 2,000 tons. Von Däniken, I believe, elsewhere claims that this is a launching ramp for a rocket. Well, it does have a tilt to it. If it didn't have a tilt to it, it'd be a launching platform, however. What is fishy about it, however, is that the bottom has got a tilt to it. You know, when you build something that you want tilted to stay tilted, you usually put a flat base on it so that it sticks in the ground on all ends. This seems to be quite parallel all the way down, so that you're really looking at a large stone block. Now, we do have a problem here, which we want to think about. Why on earth would somebody want to move a 2,000-ton block and things of that sort? In the Terrace et Baalbek, the three largest stones are not on the bottom of the foundation, they're on top. So you've got the foundation starts with relatively small stones, and then up at the top you've got these three 55-foot stones across the back, about 9 by 12 by 55 feet, weighing about 900 tons. Why that? That would be something to take into account. A very peculiar way to build something, rather peculiar way for an advanced technology to build something, too. Well, I would like to point out before we leave Baalbek, we'll skip that slide again. Well, I'll put it back up on that slide. Remark by Sprague de Camp. Our historical evidence indicates that the temple at Baalbek was built in the 2nd and 3rd centuries A.D. 2nd and 3rd centuries A.D. Some rather spectacular work was done in the building of the temple, not just these big flat stones that I mentioned. They come from very close by. The quarry out of which the large flat stones in the terrace come is about 200, 300 yards from the site. However, the pillars come from Aswan, almost 1,000 miles up the Nile. They were brought down the Nile, across the Mediterranean, and about 35 miles overland to Baalbek itself. But that's a rather interesting thing, which we'll need to take into account. At the site, we have Roman inscriptions. The architecture is Roman. The impression you get that it was built 2nd and 3rd centuries A.D. Among the Roman historians, we have no evidence of gods coming down in chariots to help out in the building of this temple. No evidence of them being given any super technology by gods visiting them. The impression you get is that, at least historically, this was built by available methods for the Romans. We'll need to consider what those might have been. Let's turn to another site which von Däniken does not deal with, but which I think is some problem to his position. That's the Acropolis at Athens. On the Acropolis, one of the most famous of the buildings, probably the most famous building on the Acropolis, is the Parthenon. Parthenon was built under the rule of Pericles, which started in the year 447 BC, finished in the year 438 BC. Built over a period of 9 years, in a historical period, from which we have Greek historians, and we have information about the rule of Pericles. We know the names of the architects. I can't give them to you off my head. Pisidius, I think, was the chief architect, a sculptor, and had several other guys, Callisthenes, a couple other guys under him. But no evidence that this was visited by Athena in a chariot and help them to build the thing. Now, why am I stressing all of this? Not because they're huge stones and the thing would be difficult to move. The stones are not fantastic in size. Some of them are rather heavy, probably would weigh over a ton. But because of some very subtle architectural principles that are involved in the building of this structure. You see, if you build a structure that has perfectly straight up and down columns, that has a perfectly flat floor, and which has the two end columns perpendicular to the ground, it won't look that way. Your eye will make the floor look like it sags. Your eye will make the end pillars look like they lean out. And your eye will make all the pillars look like they are narrow in the middle. Now, to correct for this, the architects who built the Parthenon made their pillars bulge in the middle by a very small fraction of an inch. They made the floor of the Parthenon so that it is just a slight bit higher in the center than it is on the end. And in fact, the floor follows the curve of a circle with a 3.5 mile radius. They tilted the outer pillars in just a little bit so that when you stand back, they look square. And if you run a line through the center of those two pillars, you'll find it meets about 1.5 miles up in the air. Well, that's fairly sophisticated design work there. You don't get the impression that these guys had just come out of their caves. And yet that is a feature that underlies a great deal of von Däniken's whole argumentation. We can look on the site. We've got inscriptions there, again, in Greek, referring to building and use of the place. We can see something about their building methods. The Greeks were concerned to build something that would last. They did not want to put mortar between the stones, which they knew would rot in a few centuries, and the thing would weaken. So instead, when they cut the stones out, they cut the stones out with pegs on each stone, and then holes on the other stone it would fit in. So when they drop one block down on top of the other, the pegs fit in the holes, and the thing locks together. As a result, the Parthenon was in very good shape until about 400 years ago. On top of the fall of the Roman Empire and the invasion of the Turks and all of these things, the Parthenon stood in good shape. Robbed, of course, of the gold statue that was there, various things of that sort, as you might expect, but the building itself in excellent shape. However, when the Turks were in control of Greece, they got into a war with the French, and the Turks decided this would be an excellent powder magazine, and the French decided this would be an excellent artillery target, and the French were right and the Turks were wrong. And they blew down about half of one side. But it really took gunpowder to do the job. So the Greeks built very carefully and had some very subtle architectural techniques. Von Däniken, however, feels that he's got a great advantage over regular archaeologists. He says, I'm a Sunday archaeologist, and the Sunday archaeologist has a great advantage of being able to give his imagination free rein and ask the specialist disconcerting questions. Naturally, I make the most of this advantage, etc. That's so. A person who has not studied the area has an enormous advantage over people who have. He's able to give his imagination free rein. You see, the more you study an area, the more you are narrowed down to far fewer choices for how to fit it together. When you don't know anything about the area, it can be fit together any way you want. The more you know about it, the more you have to work to get a way that you want that still fits the data. And I think everybody has to concede that there's a tendency for us to construct things the way we want them, but at least the more you study an area, the more you're forced to at least have the outlines of the data. But the von Däniken, a Sunday archaeologist, is safe from that sort of thing. Von Däniken also, as I've been pointing out several times here already, makes a big play on the primitiveness of man and on how we're progressing so much, how we're getting better and better, and how we know so much more than the ancients do. Well, individually, I doubt that many of us know much more than the ancients do, except that we've learned it from someone else, and they've learned it from someone else. As long as a civilization stays in existence for a long time and doesn't lose all its written material, there's bound to be a large increase in the total amount of material that's available for people to know. That's, you can just read it. But men in antiquity, according to anthropologists, as far back as we can trace them historically, there's no evidence that man's intelligence was less then than it is now. No evidence of that. And so I think our view that ancient man is kind of dumb is really a very oversimplified view, which is not warranted. Let's charge on to Jerusalem for a quick look at one other matter which von Däniken brings up in other regards, but not here. Here we're looking at the Western or Wailing Wall, the city of Jerusalem, a traditional site of prayer for the Jews. This is virtually the only remaining material from the ancient city of Jerusalem. It is the, that is to say, remaining in place. This is the retaining wall on the west side of the Temple Mount. Now, if you look at the upper part of the mount, upper part of the wall, you'll see it's made of rather small stones. This is Islamic architecture, and was apparently placed there by the Caliph Solomon the Magnificent, who rebuilt Jerusalem in the 1400s. As you come down, however, you see a sudden change in the size of blocks, and we come down to about the third or fourth tier here from the ground level. And this material is thought by archaeologists to be Herodian, put up by Herod the Great, who refurbished the Temple Mount in the year 19 and 20 BC. And then the work was carried on for nearly 80 years after that time, the temple being finally completed in 66 AD, in time to be destroyed in 70 AD. The bottom four courses here are thought by archaeologists to be Solomonic, or at least going back to Ezra and Nehemiah, but thought to be Solomonic, going back to King Solomon, which would date us nearly 1000 BC. And what is interesting, archaeologists have now dug down from the ground level here and found 60 more courses of stone going downward. So a very large wall. Now, these stones are not the size stones that we've got at Baalbek, but they're not small stones. If you look at the stones, you'll see that several of them are 5 or 6 feet long. They're about 3 feet high, and they're presumably about 3 feet deep. Now, if you do a quick calculation, you'll find that will weigh around 2 tons. So you're getting into some fairly heavy stones already. Not 900 tons, but not peanuts either. You're getting up to pyramid-sized stones already. 2 tons average-sized stones for the pyramid. Another picture of the same retaining wall in the southeast corner. At the city of Jerusalem, there's a model today of Jerusalem as it looked in the first century AD. And about the $2-3 million project, built of stone, covers about maybe a quarter acre or a little less of the Holy Land Hotel. I draw attention to this to point out three towers built by Herod the Great would have been during his reign, so between, say, 37 BC and 4 BC when he died. Named one for one of his friends, Agrippa, one for his brother, Phasael, one for one of his wives, Mariamne. According to the Jewish historian Josephus, there are some very large stones in these towers. He mentions a stone on the order of 25 feet long and 3 or 4 feet high, 3 or 4 feet deep. You're beginning to get already in the same ballpark as the Baalbek stones. And we ask ourselves, why did the ancients use that big of stones? Didn't they know how to cut stones in half? Yes, they knew how to cut stones in half, of course. In fact, it's a fairly hard job to move a stone that size without breaking it in half. Why did they use big stones? Well, I think there's a pretty good answer. It's given by Sprague de Camp in his book, The Ancient Engineers. In antiquity, there are many times where there have been very small city-states fighting one another. Now, in those circumstances, you have small governments, yet they collect taxes, and so they have money lying around. There are temples to various gods, and they receive offering, and if they're around for several hundred years, they amass a large amount of gold tableware and gold ornamentation and things of that sort. If that stuff stays sitting around very long, it's likely someone would come around and try to take it, particularly when you've got city-states. One city-state's a little stronger than the other, so they come over and take all their gold. Go back home. And then 20 years later, another city-state's a little stronger and they come take all their gold. Well, people don't like that, particularly the people from whom it's been taken, particularly if the fighters are all killed and the other people are carried into slavery, things of that sort, which is very common in antiquity. What do you do about it? Well, you build walls around the city. And this is what was done in antiquity, almost invariably, and has been done up until even beyond the Middle Ages, building a wall around a city. That's really why the cities in antiquity are so small. It's not because people in antiquity like to live shoulder to shoulder. It's because it's rather expensive to build stone walls, in case you've ever had a mason over to do any work for you. Even then, it's expensive to build stone walls. And they want walls that will keep people out. You can't do that with a 4-foot-high wall. Well, why big stones? Why big stones? Why not little stones? You can make a good wall out of little stones. And you don't have to use mortar if you know how to fit the stones together. They'll stay together. That's so. You can build a stone wall, and except for earthquakes, a stone wall might stay for centuries, made out of small stones. No more. But it might happen that this guy's with the other city-state that wants your dough have got a bigger army than you do. So they chase you inside of your fortifications, all right? So then their general sends a few guys up to your wall with spears, and they pick out a few stones at the bottom, and the whole wall falls down. Now it falls down the guy who's picking out the stones with a spear, but he's just a private, and the rest of the privates come plowing it over the wall when it falls down, and they haul the wall off. But if you've got a stone 25 feet long, and 6 feet high, and 6 feet deep, it takes a lot of guys with spears to pry it out. And meanwhile, you're up on top of the wall pouring boiling oil or dropping millstones on them. That's why they decided that it'd be nice to move big stones in antiquity. Yeah, it's a lot easier, of course, for the builders. They don't have people around throwing all the stuff on them. So they can build in relative peace and quiet. They can put the place together. And then when the other guys are trying to take it apart, they can dump all the stuff on them until they run out of it. And hold off a lot longer. So a city which has got a weaker army may be able to stand a siege long enough that even a much larger army cannot afford to take their wealth and cannot afford to make them slaves. So you build a wall as insurance. It's not absolute insurance, it's relative insurance, like everybody's military machine has always been. So the suggestion is, by the way, we've got archaeological evidence that this sort of wall building goes back at least 1500 BC or further. The Mycenaean civilization in Greece did this type of building. What we're suggesting here is the reason that the ancients developed a technology of this sort was a military reason. People will spend a lot of money on military defense that they will not spend on other things. You're probably aware of that by now. Even when they don't want to particularly spend it, they'll spend it. That explains, I believe, the large stones at Jerusalem, and at Mycenae, and various places like that. But it doesn't explain the large stones at Baalbek. Baalbek isn't a fortification. Baalbek's a temple. That's so. However, I think I can give you an analogy. You see, once a technology has been developed for military purposes, it does not follow it has to be used for military purposes only. We built rocket ships to throw atomic warheads at the Russians, I guess. And they built them to throw them at us. And Hitler was working on building something to do the same thing, but didn't quite get there. But we haven't only used the rockets for that purposes. Having built them, it became apparent that with a few billion dollars more, you could send a man to the moon. And so we've used it for that. A great deal of our solid-state electronics have been developed for purposes of guiding missiles and building computers for guiding missiles, and building computers for other military applications. But the spin-off is $25 desk calculators, hand calculators, that you can stick in your pocket to replace a machine that cost $1,500 and had a bunch of gears in it 15 years ago. So, but what is the non-military application of moving monster stones around? That's a good question. Probably not for building patios. But then we don't find them in patios. We find them in a big temple built by the Romans in the east. Archaeologists have suggested that this temple was built by the Romans. The Romans didn't need to build it out there for the Romans to worship in. They built it out there for the subjects to worship in, for the Syrians in that part of the empire to worship in. Why did they build it on that scale? Well, the Romans wanted to show everybody that they were the greatest, that their empire was better than any other empire had been before, that they were stronger than anybody had ever been around before, things of that sort. So one way to do that is to show off some of your military technology. And part of the military technology is big stones. Now, if you're building big stones and the thing just have a nice foundation, you'd put them down the ground. But if you're building them to show off, you put them up where you can see them. That's where they put them. So the suggestion is that the large stones at Baalbek are a spin-off from their military technology to impress the natives that their empire was the greatest. Onward. We travel to the south to Egypt. Had a chance to get there last spring. and have a look at the pyramids. Von Däniken makes a great thing about the pyramids, but he was not the first person to make a great thing about the pyramids. Peter Tompkins has a book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid, which is a history of pyramidologists, a history of people who have made spectacular discoveries about the Great Pyramids. Von Däniken does not need to do much research in this area. He can just copy out the material that people have worked up for him already over the last 200 years. So Von Däniken says, is it coincidence that the area of the base of the pyramid, the Great Pyramid he's talking about, divided by twice its height, gives the celebrated figure pi equal 3.14159? Well, that sounds pretty impressive. His statement here seems to say there must be a super technology behind this. Pi to five decimal places. Well, when you look at the Great Pyramid and see that the top is rounded off and that all the covering stone is missing, you wonder, maybe they had it to five decimal places. Is there any chance we can prove it? Probably not. But actually, when you look at the whole matter, it's a little suspicious. Suppose you take feet for the units of measurement. 756 feet is the approximate length of a side Great Pyramid. Multiply one side by the other, you get the area of the base. 571,536 square feet. Multiply the height by 2, you get 962 feet. Divide that into 571,536 square feet, you get 594.1, which is not too close to pi. Now, there's a unit in there. The answer comes out in feet. Got any engineers and physicists and stuff here? Comes out in feet. What units would you have to change it to get it to come out 3.14159? Well, you'd have to carry out a lot of extra figures to get it to come out with that many decimal places anyway. But it turns out you need a unit about 200 feet long. Well, did they have units 200 feet long in antiquity? Probably. What have we got 200 feet long? A football field. A stadium. Now, stadium's about 600 feet long. Ancient measurement stadium. There are probably some units of measurement that don't miss that by too many factors, you know, by factor two or three. But is it likely that the builder of the pyramid used a unit that long? No, it's probably not. When we build a house that's going to have sides 50 feet long, we don't usually use a unit of measurement 10 feet long. When we're going to use bricks and doors and such that are going to be a brick maybe 8 inches long and a door 2 feet wide, we use a unit of measurement that's around that size, you see, to measure our things in. So it's reasonable that the units of measurement used in the pyramid would be the size of the blocks or something, that variety, a couple feet. Probably one of the ancient foot or cubit measurements was used by the pyramid builders. So you don't get pi. You get nothing like it. Did Von Däniken investigate a source? I don't know. He just gives the answer, and the answer is wrong. Von Däniken makes another remark. This happens to be here quoted by Clifford Wilson, Crash to the Chariots, say film. Von Däniken says, is it really a coincidence that the height of the pyramid of Cheops, that's a great pyramid again, multiplied by 1,000,000,000, corresponds approximately to the distance between the Earth and the Sun. That is to say, 93 million miles. Well, you do the calculation. It's in the vicinity. It's 91.17 million miles. And if you change the, if you disagree on the height of the pyramid slightly, you can probably work it around and get it nearer than that. Is it really a coincidence? Answer, yeah, probably it is. Well, I mean, look, how many units of measurement, you know, how many dimensions are there to the pyramid? Well, there's a length of a base, there's a slant height, there's a direct height, there's the height of an average stone, there's a bunch of passages wandering around inside that you can measure the length of all of those, a number of people have, and drawn various conclusions, which have, some of them prophetic, which have wiped out rather badly, but there are all sorts of units. There are all sorts of lengths you can measure in the pyramid to start with. Second, there are all sorts of numbers you can multiply these lengths by. 1, 2, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, 100,000, 1,000,000, 2,000,000, 10. How many numbers can you multiply by? And then you can pick out distances to compare it with. There's the radius of the Earth, circumference of the Earth. Distance from the equator to the pole. There's the distance to the moon. There's the distance to the sun, yeah. There are a bunch of those things around. My guess is I would be amazed if you couldn't find a couple coincidences like this in the pyramids. So is it really a coincidence? Well, I don't know, but it's reasonable to suppose it is. You know, if you come up with 50 of these, and they're all nice round figures, that would be something else. If indeed the figure given by Wilson here for the height of the pyramid is accurate, you would be a little surprised that people traveling from some other galaxy or some other solar system, a stellar system, would get the miss the distance to the sun by a couple million miles. But that's something that's somewhat beside the point. Well, let's have another look at that pyramid. Look at all those stones. Great pyramid. There are about 2.5 million stones in this thing, and they average about 2.5 tons. That's a lot of rock. And take a while to move all that stuff. Von Däniken's estimate, Von Däniken, we'll get to his age estimate in a moment, first attacks the idea that these could possibly have been moved there by the Egyptians. He says, I shall be told that the stone blocks used for building the temple were moved on rollers. In other words, wooden rollers. But the Egyptians could scarcely have felled and turned into rollers the few trees, mainly palms, that then as now grew in Egypt, because the dates from the palms were urgently needed for food, and the trunks and fronds were the only things giving shade to the dried up ground. But they must have been wooden rollers, otherwise there would not even be the feeblest technical explanation of building the pyramids. And he goes on then to discuss the possibility of importing wood, various other things. Discusses how big a fleet you'd need. Well, you've got here again primitive man picture, urgently needed for food. You get the idea that the Egyptians were dragging around on one, you know, on one knee, food. The biblical account tells us the Israelites, after being out in the desert for a bit on fairly reasonable rations, wanted to go back to Egypt because as slaves, they had a very large variety of food back there. But here we have Von Däniken, urgently needed for food. Is it true that they would have had to use wooden rollers in the first place? Is it true that there's not even the feeblest technical explanation otherwise for how they could have moved them? Well, archaeologists could surmise various other ways of doing it, I suppose. But what's very interesting is a drawing on one of the temples in Egypt. Here it is. We have these Egyptian drawings are sometimes a little hard to interpret, but here you have a whole bunch of guys going that way. If you count them, there are about 172 of them. And it looks like they're all holding on to some long black thing. It comes back here, and in each line it swings over down to where this guy's standing. There's a little guy standing there, dumping some juice out of something on the ground. There's a big guy there that looks like he's anchored down to the thing. And then there's a little guy standing on his knees. Looks like he's clapping his hands or something. That's right. Well, since that big guy looks like a pharaoh, and since pharaohs don't usually go around tied up, and since he's a lot bigger than those other guys, one surmises that this is probably a statue of a pharaoh, because they kind of like big statues. And there's this little sled-shaped thing underneath him here that he's tied to. And you just get a real impression here that here are about 172 guys dragging a big stone statue on a sled, probably a wooden sled. And there's some guy standing on the front of the thing pouring some kind of liquid in front. Maybe it's olive oil or milk or something to reduce the friction. That's what's usually been surmised. Well, knowing the type of stone that the Egyptians used in their pharaoh statues and presuming that these men are fairly average size, you can calculate that stone statue weighs about 65 tons. That's about 30 some times bigger than heavier than the average pyramid blocks. And you got 172 guys out there dragging it. And I suppose the guy could be cheating some and not put all the guys on. But you know, if he were a non-realistic artist, he could have gotten by with less than that. So the impression you get here is that 172 guys can drag the thing, and I think we'll find some evidence for that later. Well, here's a feeble technical explanation given by an ancient Egyptian for how to move big stones. And there's at least a possibility you've seen it happen. So, there you go. Well, now if you go down to 2.5-ton blocks, you find it only takes about 8 of these guys to move one of those. And this is calculated here, although it doesn't take a great deal of work, by spreading the camp. And so on the level, moving on flat, it looks like about 8 guys can move a 2.5-ton stone. Okay, you got 2.5 million tons, you got 2.5 million stones, 8 guys per stone. You need about, well, I'll mess it up. I'm not good at figuring in my head. 18 or 19 million guys, huh? But it is possible that the 8 guys, after they pull one stone over to the site, could go back and get another one. So it is possible to cut the number of men down a little bit. So at least getting all the stones to the site would not be a major problem, apparently, if you've got a lot of guys to work with. Now, as it happens, we know from antiquity that Egypt had a very totalitarian economy and operation. And also, that although they were basically agriculturally based, there was a period of a month or two every year when the Nile had overflowed its banks and covered all the agricultural land, and so the agricultural laborers couldn't work on agriculture. So it follows that the pharaohs, after several dynasties, looking around and wondering what they could do with all the surplus labor to keep them from having a civil war, might have struck upon the idea of building big tombstones. And that's a suggestion here. Von Däniken claims that that it would take 676 years to build a Great Pyramid by the methods that he thinks, by the HEFO method, which he, as he calls this particular method we've been discussing. And so, therefore says, it's very unlikely then that the Great Pyramid would ever have gotten built. That is safe to say. If it took 676 years, if it would have taken 676 years, it's safe to say it would probably never have gotten built. However, he ignores the fact that an ancient Greek historian, Herodotus, tells us that it took 20 years to build the Great Pyramid. He says it took 100,000 men 20 years to build the Great Pyramid. Sprague de Camp thinks it would not have taken that many men. He multiplies 20 years by 100,000 men, and it's 2 million man years of labor, and says shouldn't have taken that long. Well, probably shouldn't. However, we don't know they're working all year. When he says it takes 20 years, it does not necessarily mean that it took 12 months a year, 20 years. It might have taken a month a year or a couple months a year for 20 years. So the fact that Sprague de Camp suggests it would take much less time, it probably could take much less time if they could get men together to do it the whole time, but we do not assume that. It is interesting, however, that another pyramid in Egypt at Dasher, if the dates are accurate, and if the stones were put there in the course of building the other stones up, then about half of a pyramid about two-thirds as big was built in less than 2 years. Therefore, the suggestion that it took 20 years to build a pyramid, a Great Pyramid, is not outrageous. And I think we can take Herodotus' word for that in face of having no other explicit evidence on that particular pyramid. Another thing which von Däniken frequently makes a great case about is the fine fit of stones in certain different places in the world. It says you can't stick a knife blade between the stones, as they now say. This is a pyramid. This is a temple at the Sphinx in Egypt, and you do have very fine stone jointing here. And you often will have trouble sticking a knife blade between them. He says this must mean that they were cut with lasers, laid together. Sprague de Camp has a rather interesting remark about this. It is true that when you look at the casing around the pyramids, you often cannot stick a knife blade between the adjoining stones. But what he points out is that if you look at a joint here between two stones and then come over and look at a vertical joint here between the next two stones, or move over to another and look at the next one, they're not parallel. There's a little tilt to them. Askew. Randomly askew. Well, that's a very suspicious thing for a technology with lasers and intergalactic travel. But it's not a very suspicious thing if the Egyptians had some way of making stones fit, but they did not have a good way or were not worried about taking the trouble to to make sure that all of the joints were parallel to each other. In fact, we know that the Egyptians, from pictures, used copper saws to saw their limestone. Now, copper is not as hard as limestone, but you can put a grit on it so that it does cut limestone. Just like paper is not as hard as gemstone or steel, but you can put a grit on the paper, so they're called sandpaper, and you can cut steel. So the impression we get is that Egyptians brought the two stones and set them side by side, and they would not, you'd be able to stick a knife blade in several places, so they ran a saw down between them and shoved them together. And you might still be able to fit a knife blade in a couple spots, so they run a saw down again, them together, until they've got them so that you can't get one down, then they push them into place. Then they do it over here. But you can see there's no reason why this joint should be parallel with this joint over here, because of just using a saw right out on the field. My brother was with me on this tour of the Middle East last spring, and so I got him to pose with my pocket knife, trying to thrust it between the joints of a stone in the Colosseum in Rome, and sure enough, you couldn't get it in. Now, this Colosseum was built in the 1st century AD by Titus and Vespasian. We have no evidence that any men came in fiery chariots or spaceships, they wouldn't have had the term spaceships in von Däniken's view, though, and helped them build this thing. Yet they've got the same kind of stonework. Sprague de Camp, I think, summarizes the secrets of the Great Pyramids and the secrets of ancient engineering in general as three. The ancients did have simple tools. They did have simple machines. They used them intentionally, and they used them carefully. The ancients, throughout the whole period when there was slavery going on, had virtually unlimited and cheap labor, and they were therefore able to use it. The reason why a lot of our buildings is much sloppier, if you like, than ancient buildings is because cost of labor is so high. You can't spend as much time on stuff. You're going to get it built at a reasonable cost, you build it quickly. You cut corners. They didn't cut corners. And the third thing, which is closely related to this, they weren't in a rush. The Pharaoh was quite satisfied that the thing he finished when he was dead, and he was in no rush to die. So, build a good one. Well, we come to one of von Däniken's strongest points now, and that's the matter of Easter Island. Easter Island is a rather small volcanic island, perhaps 2 miles by 4 miles, lying in the South Pacific, almost 2,000 miles from any other land, period. Not just from the continent, from any other land. On this island, there are hundreds of stone heads, 30 and 35 feet tall. The population of the island is about 200. Von Däniken had field there. Even if people with lively imaginations, he says, have tried to picture the Egyptian pyramids being built by a vast army of workers using the heave-ho method, a similar method would have been impossible on Easter Island for lack of manpower. Even 2,000 men working night and day would not be nearly enough to carve these colossal figures out of the steel-hard volcanic stone with rudimentary tools. And at least a part of the population must have tilled the barren fields, gone fishing, woven cloth, and made ropes. Starvation theme comes in here again. No 2,000 men alone could not have made the gigantic statue, and a larger population is inconceivable on Easter Island. Then who did do the work, and how did they manage it? And why did the stone stand around the edge of the island and not in the interior? Not sure what that last question has to do with. Maybe they want to show them off, if anyone from 2,000 miles away should come by. But we're not concerned about that question. Rather impressive. Rather impressive. Unfortunately, there's been a book in print for a number of years on this subject by Thor Heyerdahl, rather well-known figure, from his Kon-Tiki balsa raft going across the South Pacific, and his a raw papyrus raft going across the Atlantic on the second try. He made a visit, a rather extensive visit, with several archaeologists, and spent several months at Easter Island. Here we see Thor Heyerdahl sitting on top of one of these heads, measuring the height, making a good picture, various other things. Heyerdahl, when he got there, learned that there were traditions on the island regarding these heads. He understood from the people that most of them were descendants of a group of people who had been the labor in this project, and that they had been led by another group whom they called the Long Ears, who apparently had their ears mutilated to make them long, who had been the masters, so to speak, and who had run the project. The Short Ears, if you want to call them that, had gotten tired of working for the Long Ears and had decided to put a stop to it. And according to the tradition, the Long Ears had gotten afraid, had dug a trench across the island, and had barricaded themselves in one side of the island. Through treachery, the Short Ears had gotten in behind them, and the Long Ears had built a big ready-to-go bonfire wood set up in the trenches, and as soon as an attack came, they would light it, and some of the Short Ears had gotten in behind them, and when the attack started from outside, they lit the bonfires, the Long Ears did, and then the Short Ears came up behind and drove them into the fire and killed off all but one of the Long Ears. This was confirmed by archaeological investigations that at least there was a large trench there with a great deal of ashes in it that seemed to have been such a thing. It runs all the way across the island, blocking it off into two pieces, and the dating on the material seems to agree with the suggestion this happened about 12 generations ago. One person survived of the Long Ears, a kid, and his descendants were still alive, formed maybe about 40 people out of that. Well, not smaller than that, about a dozen people, a little more than that, out of the 200 or so on the island, were related to him in some way. He talked to these Long Ears, and they said they knew how the stones were carved, they knew how the stones were moved, and they knew how the stones were raised up. This particular stone that we see here is not a finished stone. The finished stone would have been moved out to the edge of the island, set up on a platform, and have a hat put on top of them. A stone, red stone hat, actually not hat, but a hairdo, but made out of a different color stone, weighing a couple tons, set up on top, 35 feet in the air, on top of the thing. And the early white visitors to the place agreed that there were such statues standing at that time, and the Short Ears, being irked about the thought of all the work they had done for the Long Ears, gradually toppled them all over, so that there are now about 100 of the stones lying on their nose or their back or something near their platform with the hats toppled off and such. So these are unfinished ones still near the site where they're prepared. Well, Heyerdahl managed to get these guys to agree that if he would provide their room and board, so to speak, for some time, they would try and show him how they had carved these things. So he got six of them to agree to do it. And they went to the place. They'd never done it themselves. They had only oral tradition on how it was done. They got out the picks and stuff that were laying around, still laying around the quarry. There are hundreds of these little picks laying around the quarry. They're just a little hand, just a piece of stone, chiseled by hand. They're harder than the volcanic stone that the heads are made out of. Went over to a bare wall and began hacking on it. As they hacked on, very slow work, they poured water on the stuff to weaken the structure of the rock. After about a week or so, they gave up. They were not used to this sort of thing, but they had gotten this far in a week. Independent calculations were made by Heyerdahl and a couple of the guys themselves, and they estimated it would take about a year to turn out one of these heads. A half dozen guys working normal length days could turn out a head a year. There are about 200 of these heads on the island, so one crew could have turned out all of the heads in 2 centuries. Two crews could have turned out all the heads in a century, four crews, half century, etc. We know archaeologically that this group was here for something like 5 centuries. So there seems to be a reasonable time to have carried it out if they wanted to go to trouble. Well, that would seem to solve part of the problem, but not a great deal of it. How do you get the thing to the site, and how do you get them standing up on the platform? Well, the Long Ears, the descendants of the Long Ears, said they knew how to do that too. And if he would put up the room and board, they would put up the labor. So he said, okay, they went over to about a 50-ton statue sitting on its nose, 12 feet away from its platform. Platform's about 4 feet high. Okay, put it back. Well, would they use the heave-ho method? They'd say, okay, boys, ready? Ha! You know? No, there were only 12 guys going to work on the project. So That was a little heavy. 12 guys, that's about 4 tons apiece. A little tough. What did they do? Well, there are some trees on Easter Island, and they're not quite telephone poles, but they're reasonable. They cut 3 or 4 trees, made these long poles, stuck 3 of them under the thing, and they got out on the ends of them, you know, get a little leverage. Strange. Ancients knew about leverage. Not hard to figure out. You don't have to know the moment arm and make it. Yeah. So, they all but one of them get out there and heave on the thing, and the statue moves a little bit. And the other guy, he's not over there shouting orders, he's down next to the statue. And he sticks some pebbles under it. And he let it down, it doesn't go down as far. They heave it up again, stick some bigger pebbles under it. They heave it up again, they stick some bigger pebbles under it. After a while, they really got a lot of pebbles under it. They're getting up to as big a rock as you can carry, and they've got that kind of a pile under the thing. The thing is still nose down, kind of vaguely facing us. This is the head towards us this way. And they're working it up. They're building a big pile of stones under the thing by prying it up and shoving stones under. Now, while they're doing this, they aren't just sitting it up here, and then they finish the job and they say, uh-oh, the platform's 12 feet over there. They're putting the stones on in such a way to drift the thing back towards the platform until they've got the base of it in the center of the platform. The base is up 4 feet. The other end is up probably twice that high or more than that. And they've got the thing nailed back over the platform. Finally, on the 18th day, 12 men, 18 days, they get the thing up like this. Feet down on the platform, not feet actually, the belt, or a little below the belt is where the statue stops. But on the platform, they put homemade rope, they knew how to make rope there, put the rope around the thing, and finally give a last little heave, heave-ho method if you like, clunk, the thing sets up, a little noise during that probably. The rope starts to make sure that it doesn't keep going, you know, and to do it very carefully. There you are. 12 guys, 18 days, one statue, set up on the platform. Now, 12 guys can't move a thing. This would be a rather slow way to move it a mile and a half from the quarry. Yeah. But Heyerdahl tried to see if they could move it with the people on the island. Well, he had an idea for this. He had a luau for them, what the Hawaiians would call a luau. All got together, a little fun, and they get out there, the whole 200 of them, kids, women, pull on the thing, the rope breaks. Well, of course, modern American engineering, back to the factory, design a new rope, send out a study group, see if we can get better materials. 2 years later, $50,000, new rope, come back. Primitives don't do that, double the rope. Pull it, it moves. And, uh, 180 people, including women and children, moved it like a cardboard box, it said. Moving right along. So what have we got here? You need about 2 or 3, maybe even 1, crew making the thing. Takes them a year apiece. You need 1 crew for about a month per statue to set the thing up. And you need the whole island population of half or a third of it probably to do the job to move them. So suppose you turn out 1 statue a year, you need 6 guys turning out the statue, you need for all the time. They gotta work all the time. You need about a dozen guys for about a month to set it up, and you need everybody for maybe a day to move it. Turn out statue a year, 100 years, 200 years, you got the job done. Now, we've got, why'd they do it? I don't know why they did it. But if you want to ask why they did it, why would spacemen do it? I mean, what he was. They did it. They did it. That's all we can say. I mean, people have been asking why we went to the moon, and I'm not sure we can answer that. We certainly can't answer that to satisfy everybody, that's for sure. But I presume these people have satisfactory reasons. In fact, Heyerdahl has made an excellent case archaeologically that these people are from South America. They did not invent this technology themselves, they brought it. And that we don't know who invented the technology, that they were used to doing this sort of thing, and they perhaps wanted to remember their heritage. And there may have been religious significance to it. It would not be at all surprising if there were. But no evidence that spacemen were necessary at the point. Were there spacemen? I don't know. No evidence that they were necessary. The same sort of thing could then presumably have been done by the men at Stonehenge. We don't know that they did it the same way. The artist whose stuff I've copied here suggests wooden rollers. Maybe they used wooden rollers. Maybe they used a wooden sled. It's not likely that they used UFOs. How did they set it up? Maybe they used stones. Maybe they used wood, as you suggest here. This actually is a rather similar method when you look at it. But as far as we know, the Easter Islanders have not been reading this sort of literature and getting ideas. It appears that that their remarks about your own tradition are to be taken at face value. You've been able to check them out rather well. So a suggestion just here is that it can be done by primitives, and we presume that the men at Stonehenge had a way to do it. It may not have been identical to that of Easter Island. Von Däniken also gets into biblical exegesis, and here he really shines. Undoubtedly, the Ark was electrically charged. He's talking about the Ark of the Covenant, not Noah's Ark here, by the way. He refers back to the passage in 2 Samuel chapter 6, where the Ark is being hauled along on a cart, and it looks like it starts to flip, and a guy sticks out his hand to touch it, and he's struck dead. So, he fell dead on the spot as if struck by lightning. Undoubtedly, the Ark was electrically charged. If we reconstruct it today, according to the instructions handed down by Moses, an electric conductor of several hundred thousand volts is produced. Electrical engineering was not my specialty, but I did have a couple courses in it. I don't recall conductors being referred to as having so many volts. It's possible if there was a slip-up for a condenser, where an electric condenser holding a charge of several hundred thousand volts, or several hundred volts, I don't know. If you construct the Ark of the Covenant according to the instructions handed down to Moses, what you have is a wooden job with a gold leaf cover. Gold leaf covering will conduct electricity, that's safe to say. It doesn't make a very good condenser because, as far as we can tell, the top was completely covered with the gold leaf, the bottom was covered by the gold leaf, and when you put them together, that connects the inside and outside covering, the inside and outside gold leaf, because you lay that across the stuff that was covered. Those edges. The border and golden crown would have served to charge the condenser, which was formed by the gold plates in a positive and negative conductor. If, in addition, one of the two cherubim on the mercy seat acted as a magnet, the loud speaker was perfect. Well, that's a bit hard to buy, but I haven't got time to explain it tonight. Von Däniken's treatment of archaeology is in the same ballpark. But less people know about archaeology than know about what the biblical material says, perhaps. Picture the Ark for your edification. We don't know exactly what it looked like. This is somebody's idea based on the description that we do have in Exodus. A rather outrageous remark occurs at the bottom of the same page we've been looking at. Von Däniken says, without actually consulting Exodus, I seem to remember that the Ark was often surrounded by flashing sparks. What kind of research is that? I mean, you know, a slide talk like this, you know, I'm trying to pull something out of my head, I might say, without actually consulting something I seem to remember. Actually, I never seem to remember. I either remember or I don't remember, usually. But writing a book, if he consulted Exodus in the first place, he would find out his memory was wrong. I mean, I don't know how to prove that to you if he's not read Exodus, but try it out sometime. The Ark is not surrounded by flashing sparks. This is, I think, characteristic of his whole position. He is using an area that not many people know much about. He brings in a great deal of facts that people are not familiar with. He marshals them himself, and he brings them out and pushes for his case. He's also using several things which people are enthusiastic about. Many people are enthusiastic about UFOs. He uses that, which is popular. He uses debunking religion, which is a popular thing these days. And then he uses his argumentative method, which is just very fishy. Perhaps the biggest thing he uses is extrapolation.
Believing in the future as I do, he says, my fantasy runs away with me. He believes that things are getting better and better and better and better. So if you wait a couple billion years, man will be so technological that he could do all of these things that the Bible pictures as miracles. And so that must have been what happened. Somebody came from another planet. But we tried to show that his archaeological material does not support that sort of interpretation. It certainly does not require that sort of interpretation. Does not support the interpretation. And that he is really mishandling his material. I will make an attempt here to answer any questions you might have. I'm not a complete expert on the matter, so I will not guarantee I can answer any of your questions. I think I can answer a number that go beyond this material. I would like tomorrow to examine material in Scripture relating to astronomy, because I think it does point to something rather spectacular. It seems to me that it suggests that the source of information for material in the Scripture on astronomy comes from someone who designed the universe. Now, von Däniken's alternative would be commonly put forward, and that's one reason I've dealt with it tonight. To show that the archaeological foundation for von Däniken's claim that some spacemen might have visited and given this thing is not well-founded. I have not answered all possible questions that could be answered, and I'll be happy to give a try for a few more of any people that would be interested in that. But thank you for your attention, and trust that you may be able to come back tomorrow evening, examine with us biblical statements regarding astronomy, comparing them with other ancient statements regarding astronomy, and comparing them with modern knowledge of astronomy. And I think we'll find some very interesting features. Thank you then for your attention.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, 19440.